Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast, episode 469. Union Live, 1991, New and Old Songs.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 469 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. Do please get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I have been listening to and watching some recordings of the Union Tour in 1991. It's a special one for Mark, as it was his first experience of Yes Live. What a way to start. Listen out for our thoughts on that a little later in the episode when we compare notes on a couple of live versions of songs from the Union album and a couple of older songs. Around the social webs this week, and starting with Facebook, Preston Frazier shared the Something Else Reviews interview with Tony Kaye, which is interesting to read in the context of our recent episodes. And Preston also posted his new vinyl version of the live House of Yes set, which looks amazing. I passed on Dave Watkinson's post about a Chris Squire stage costume, which is up for sale, and also Tom Brislin's notification that the Magnification Live DVD, Symphonic Live, is currently available for free at Peacock TV, although in a cut-down version. In the community posts, Jeffrey Mason added the following. A review of the official Rick Wakeman Bootleg Series 7 from Tokyo in 2008, an interview hosted by Redbeard about the Yes album, which is now 50 years old, where he talks to John Anderson, Chris Squire, Tony Kaye, and Bill Bruford, plus their new guitarist, Steve Howe. It's from July 1988. Mark Essay, I hope that's how you pronounce it, five-part The Making Of radio documentary on the Yes album, Sonic Perspectives Views on Arc of Life, and a scan of the original Atlantic Records ad for Anderson's debut solo album from the September 1976 issue of A Rock Around the World. Doug Curran posted his two different signed copies of the Yes album, and Mike O'Connor shared King Crimson playing Dinosaur live on Conan O'Brien's TV show with Tony Levin and Bill Bruford. Over on the Twitter, I tweeted my Fly From Here 2011 Japanese tour folder, which was sent to me 10 years ago by the generous Mishiru Kuruma, and apologies for spelling your name wrongly. I celebrated 1,000 followers on Instagram, and I showed off a few bits of my tour motto collection to stunned gasps of enjoyment, or at least in my own head, anyway. Charlie Nolan sent in a comment via Messenger, and this is what he said. Hello, Kevin and Mark. In reference to the recent YMP 468 Tony Kaye, the Power Trio Tony Kaye podcast, I have a few thoughts. Tony and the Synths. In 1984 or 1985, a lengthy interview was conducted with Kaye and Trevor Rabin about what technology they'd used for 90125 and the tour. It was a magazine that featured the then new MIDI technology. Tony was well-versed in the intricacies of the latest synth technology. As a non-player, that information was way over my head. He answered the interviewer's questions as if he'd been playing MIDI for years. Also, with the PF tribute song, I want to believe that Billy would want Tony to play all of those synth parts out of respect for him. As for the Power Trio thoughts, a headline of a 1976-77 Melody Maker I still have around had this headline, Wakeman, Wetton and Bruford, in big letters. Exciting. However, it was later learned that A&M Records refused to let Wakeman go forth with the project. The song Beelzebub was a song they had worked on and ended up on Bill's first solo album, Feels Good to Me. Of course, we all know about XYZ, another power trio that lasted for a few months and four demos. Finally, Torn, Levin and White was another studio power trio that came to mind. From what I recall, Alan recorded several drum recordings, sent them to Tony Levin and David Torn, who then shaped his drumming to their three-piece conception. Alan did quite well with that one. So once again, another YMP topic of great interest. Many thanks, Charlie. Gary Andrews reminded me about the Tony Kaye music and video called End of Innocence, which he might be reworking at the moment, and I mentioned on the show some time ago. Hopefully we will see that back again at some point. So many thanks indeed to everyone who contacted the show this week in any way.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
Mark, Mark and I have decided, as I've already said, to have some fun listening to and watching a show from the Union Tour, and specifically for me, the Denver concert, which was filmed on Thursday, May the 9th, 1991, which, according to Forgotten Yesterdays, is 29 years, 9 months and 8 days ago as I write this. The whole concert, 90 minutes of which was broadcast on TV, has long been available in bootleg form and is now on YouTube. If you're lucky enough to have the Union Live Limited Edition DVD, unlike me, it's among the bonus material on that as well. Although the entire show is fantastic, we've decided to concentrate on one brand new song from the Union album and one older, more what you might call classic Yes song each. So I'm starting with one of the few songs from Union which has ever been played live, Shock to the System. In fact, according to Forgotten Yesterdays again, only 5 of the 14 songs from Union have ever seen the light of day, or dark of night, in concert. Shock to the System was played 81 times on the tour, while the most frequent setlist appearance was by Lift Me Up at 152 performances, although about half of those were at concerts by Yes featuring ARW in 2016-18, so you can call it 81 outings, if you like. Steve Howe has played his solo piece Masquerade 56 times over the years, and Saving My Heart only made it to 26 events. Finally, Take the Water to the Mountain has only been played once, apparently, in Pensacola, Florida in April 1991, which is one of the shows included in the bonus features on that DVD. It's a shaky audience shot video, unless I haven't found better footage that exists somewhere else, and perhaps it's no surprise this song wasn't repeated because even John Anderson sounds a lot less confident than normal when singing it. There's some great Bill Bruford electronic percussion on it and some fine Howe soloing, but it doesn't really seem to go anywhere very convincingly. It does morph pleasingly into Soon, however, so that's a bonus. Anyway, back to Shock to the System. Anderson says, "Do you want to hear a new song?" Would I be correct in thinking that the answer in 1991 from the majority of the crowd was actually no? Maybe, maybe not. Regardless of the inaudible answer, I imagine it was meant as a rhetorical question and the band play Shock to the System anyway. Now, the thing is about this song in this live environment, I actually much prefer it to the recorded version, and it makes me wonder what the album could have sounded like if these 8 musicians had actually been in the studio together at any point in the creation of the album. It blasts off with that huge riff, and the integration of Howe and Rabin guitars works surprisingly well. Trevor supplies massive rock, which is contrasted by Howe's spindly Telecaster soloing in the stratosphere. There are little touches in the guitar parts I don't recognise from the album, and it seems like the refrain, the instrumental parts, and the general feel was created specifically for playing live. Keyboards and drums are in supporting roles, but that's okay. The Howe solo hook is a brilliant, catchy one, and I suppose the only person who seems to be missing from the melee is surprisingly Chris Squire. We do see him enjoying himself alongside Trevor Rabin, and it's this point where I realise what he's been doing throughout, playing the main riff in unison with the guitar, and generally providing the root and basis of the song. Shock to the System goes really well in this context, and the musicians are clearly having a lot of fun with it, even Steve Howe in his own way, and it's a delight to see them all on the stage. Clearly this is not a sublime, beautiful moment of Yes music, but it's a whole lot of fun and a fantastic live romp. So on to my selection for an older Yes song from this concert. And actually, I can't resist letting the film play on when I hear that the next song is Heart of the Sunrise. So, here we go. This is one that perhaps shouldn't work with doubled or additional parts. It's fascinating to hear Bruford's electronic kit on this, but of course he mainly sticks to the bass drum, snare and cymbals, so there's not much of an electronic aspect to the sound. After the roaring opening blasts, Chris Squire gets to play around with his walking bass line, which he treats freely and comically. However, it's his interplay with Bruford which catches the eye and the ear. Bruford doesn't do much, but that's his genius. Every stroke is perfectly judged for this situation, and soon we're back to the opening passages with a huge smile on our faces. Howe and Rabin are seen face to face, which is great, and they're joined by Squire. What a treat for all fans. Tony Kaye is ripping it up on his single keyboard, although perhaps he could have been a lot higher in this particular mix, and then the music ebbs to the opening vocals. Anderson sings Dream On to the Heart of the Sunrise beautifully, and Wakeman adds additional keyboard runs which actually enhance the ensemble rather than detract. I'm always surprised White and Bruford managed to combine their instruments, but it all melds beautifully. I'd prefer to hear a bit more of Kaye's Hammond sound, but overall, I have absolutely no serious complaints. It's a great version of the song. There is a surprisingly large amount of musical communication between Howe and Rabin, and what a joy to see Wakeman dash around his setup as he jumps to a different instrument for each breakneck change of voice. The mix is often a bit rough, but in a way I'd rather hear this than a studio mixed and polished version. It's a very exciting rendition which navigates all the musical corners beautifully, and as I mentioned before, I'm amazed there isn't more congestion, given the number of Yes Men involved. Frankly, it's brilliant.
Greetings, friends. Well, this week, Kevin and I have decided to take a look back at a record that we haven't looked back at for quite a long, 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 long time. How long a time? A very long time. And what is that album? Well, that album is Union Live. And I can't even really remember the last time we spoke about this record, but this week we decided to take a look at it, and each of us chose one album from the Union album that they performed live during this tour and on this release. And the other is a classic song that they performed during this tour and on this release. So I'm going to talk to you about Saving My Heart as the song that they performed from the Union album. And this song I always found was a sort of interesting song, being that it has quite the sort of reggae influence on it. It's not really a song that I would have expected to hear coming from Trevor Rabin, and it's pretty well known that he's pretty much the main writer of this song. This song, Lift Me Up and The Miracle of Life were the three contributions that he did put on the Union album, and this one being the oddest one in my opinion. It almost seems like a song that John Anderson would have probably written. It would have fit in any one of his albums. But it seems to work pretty well in this context. It gave him a chance to play a bit more acoustic guitar, as it was sort of tied in with his solo piece that he performed during the tour. Another interesting thing about this, and I'm not sure if they did this every time they performed live in concert during this time, but in the DVD release version of it, this was the part where members of the road crew came out with Budweiser beer can boxes on their heads and did a sort of interesting little jive march in unison with the music. I know Rick Wakeman and Bill Bruford in particular took great interest and found it extremely humorous. I'm not sure how humorous Steve Howe found it, but, you know, he just doesn't seem to find anything humorous sometimes. But it was all in good fun, and the song was performed very well. I thought that Trevor and John sang it very well. It's also one of the rare opportunities we get to see Chris Squire pull out his four-string bass that is sort of modified. If you take a look at it, it's a very long scale neck, because I know that he doesn't like performing with five-string basses very often. So he asked the makers of this bass, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, the company is V'ger that did that bass, to make a longer scale bass neck for him so that he could tune down to those low strings like the low B or C sharp and can still just have it on four strings instead of having to put on a fifth string. And this bass always sounds very good live. He's used it for songs like, this one, and he's used it for, what was that song off of? Oh, so Turn of the Century. There you go. I knew it would come to me. He's used it for Turn of the Century as well. But I think overall, this song is kind of one of those lighthearted moments in the show, and one that, you know, the guys seem to take great enjoyment in singing. It's a very fun song to sing. There's lots of harmonies in there as well. The drummers get to have a little bit of a break during the song as well. So overall, I kind of took this song as a sort of respite and also a kind of a extension of Trevor Rabin's acoustic guitar moment. Now, the other song that I chose to pick was the opening song, the 13-14 minute opus that is Yours Is No Disgrace. The reason why I decided to pick this song, besides the fact that it's such a great song, is that I think that this is probably the best song to show the band members and the strengths that they all bring to the band at this time. I mean, if you take a look at how it's constructed, you know, they're all playing in unison for most of the song, but then we get into certain sections and you start seeing little units break off. Like when we get into Steve Howe's solo section, it kind of drifts over to seeing Bill Bruford on drums, Chris on bass, obviously, Steve Howe doing his part, and Rick Wakeman sort of, you know, accompanying him here and there on keyboards. It's almost like a throwback to the early days of Yes, when that section comes up. Now, when we get to the end of Steve's solo, we get over to Trevor's moment in the sun when he does his sort of guitar solo piece in that section. And now gone is Bill from the drums, and we have Alan White now. And really, it starts off a sort of Alan, Trevor, Chris, Rick, and Tony segment, but it quickly becomes a Alan and Trevor moment where they really go off the deep end with some of this performing. Now, to me, what this kind of almost symbolizes is almost like a old school Yes, where Steve Howe played a lot of his more jazzier influenced stuff and showed where Yes were back in 71 when they did this album. And then you have Trevor Rabin, when he comes up and shows his bit of it, how he kind of modernized Yes. A lot of two-hand tapping, a lot of very fast guitar playing and riffs. And you have Alan White doing all kinds of crazy style drumming fills and, you know, all kinds of beats and stuff like that underneath it. And it's a really interesting moment, I find, as a musician, as well as a fan, to see how they kind of approached the section much differently than how it was on album and how Steve Howe approached it. Also, when you take a look at how the song started, you have Bill Bruford adding in all kinds of interesting percussion from the Simmons drums. Now, I mean, sure, he could have played the beats and all the simple drum patterns like he did back in the day and accompany Alan, but it would have made no sense, I think, to have them doing the same thing. This is what was one of the great things about having two drummers, is that, you know, you could have Bill in there kind of tail off and do some interesting added parts that were never on the song to begin with. And I think it adds a lot of life to the song. And Tony and Rick are such different players. I think anytime they're put in a situation where they're playing together, they're never going to play the same things, and it just adds to it and turns it into one really grandiose keyboard section overall. So I think it turned out fantastic. That song has always been one of my favorites, and we can't also forget Chris Squire's fantastic bass playing and those ultra subharmonic lows that he gets from those bass pedals. I mean, I have a great bootleg recording of this from Pennsylvania when they did the they played an open air outside venue sort of thing, and they opened with this, obviously. And I remember the recording that I got from this, it's like a soundboard recording, it has so much of the bass pedals on this recording that I remember my car shook totally whenever Chris would step on that pedal. It's unbelievable. One of my favorite moments of the show. But yeah, fantastic performances. I really suggest that if anybody does not own Union Live on DVD or on CD. And there's also a fantastic vinyl release of it, which I'm very happy to own. It's on, I believe it's on 3 albums. I can't remember right now. It's down in my man cave, so I haven't brought it up to take a look. But it's on vinyl, and it sounds fantastic, actually. So if you don't have that, you might want to seek that out. It's a great addition to any Yes vinyl collection. So those are my thoughts on the two songs from Union Live. Let's go over to Kevin and talk about this further.
Rolling back the years and talking to Mark now about Union Live. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. What about yourself?
Not too bad. Finally done the shoveling. We got bombarded with snow, but now it's a nice sunny day.
Lovely. Yeah, sunny here as well. Okay, so we're going to talk about this era of the band, the Union era. And in fact, we've ended up talking about several different shows. There are several shows, only one of which was ever officially released, I think. But on the DVD, there are some what are essentially bootleg recordings, but then included on a special edition of the Yes Union Live DVD. And if you're lucky enough to have that, as I said in my piece, I don't have that. All I have, actually, of an official nature of this whole tour is the Union Live CD, the basic one, which has got two CDs. And has a good selection, but not a full idea, I don't think, of one of those concerts. And of course, Mark, particularly interested in this era of the live band, because this is the first time you saw Yes, wasn't it, on the Union Tour?
Yeah, it was. That was my introduction to Yes Live. I mean, I remember I seen them at the Toronto Sky Dome, and it was a very memorable experience, to say the least.
Absolutely, with all those Yes men on the stage together. And at this point, I usually say that I did see posters for advertising Union concert, the one in Wembley, but I was at college and I couldn't afford the tickets, and I couldn't afford to get myself down to London, sadly, because that could have been my first introduction to the band as well. And what an amazing introduction that certainly would have been. So you spoke about Saving My Heart, And you pointed out that it was sort of light-hearted. And that's one of those things about Yes, isn't it, sometimes? Maybe, now I may get shot for saying this, but maybe the Steve Howe lineups and the concerts with him in, apart from the Union ones, are not light-hearted enough. What do you reckon, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, it's a point that's valid, I think. John Anderson seemed to be in good spirits on the show, and he usually seems to be in good spirits when he's playing a live concert. I think he's in his element when he's, you know, playing a concert. So, you know, on this version of the song, he had this big wind-up and, you know, introduction to Saving My Heart. And it had just come off after Trevor's acoustic guitar solo bit, so it played into it perfectly. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think John likes to add that kind of element of happiness and positivity to everything that he does. And, you know, I don't think that the current Yes, it's nothing negative or anything, but I think that there's definitely more of an era or an aura of seriousness and professionalism with that more than what John might do sometimes.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, when I went to see ARW with that particular lineup, it was, yes, there were a lot of lighthearted moments. And when you've got Rick Wakeman in the band, of course, lighthearted moments aren't ever very far away. and as you say, yes. John did used to keep the crowd going and said some pretty weird and wonderful things, of course, at times, but also kept everybody very, very happy. And that's what a great front man does, of course. So the other thing that you talked about was Yours Is No Disgrace, the other song. And you mentioned the interplay and different sections, different combinations of players. And that's one of the huge advantages, isn't it, of having lots of Yes men on there together. And the only sort of version of that I've seen has been Billy Sherwood and him coming out to the front and doing some solos and things and playing around with the different members. But the kind of combinations that you have here, and I actually saw quite a bit in the excerpts I watched of one of the concerts, of how Rabin interaction, which I really wasn't expecting, but Howe made a point actually of going over to Rabin at various points, and they played together and played their complementary parts. But yes, what an amazing time to have, what an amazing experience to have, you know, the ability to see Chris Squire interacting with Trevor Rabin, but at the same time him interacting with Steve Howe as well, and the drummers and Bill Bruford. Wow, I mean, it was just mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah, I think it definitely was a fantastic performance. Yours Is No Disgrace, I always thought was a fantastic opener. And one of the things I loved about it is, like I said in my piece, I think it definitely is a moment where they kind of show what each certain section of the lineup brought to Yes Music. Because when they go into that little middle solo section, you know, it drops down to Bill Bruford, Steve Howe, Chris Squire, a little bit of Rick Wakeman. And it's very much that kind of jazzy, you know, prog rockish sort of element that we were so used to when Steve Howe joined the band. Then you cut over to when Trevor Rabin does it. Now it's Alan White and him, and it's much more 80s rock, two-handed tapping, blistering soloing, crazy drumming from Alan on drums, right? And it just shows that, you know, in this lineup, they could do everything. They could do the 70s style jazz fusion stuff, and then they can quickly on a dime turn over and do the more modern, up-to-date, current kind of, you know, rock influenced progressive stuff, which they did with Trevor. I think it was fantastic. And one of the things I always found fascinating about it is that Chris Squire in the documentary pointed out that, you know, in the round stage when they had it, Trevor and Steve were as far apart as humanly possibly could be from each other. And even on this stage, when they on the official release, it was just a regular stage, not a round one. They were again as far apart as possible, and Steve always made it a point that he was very annoyed, let's just say that, with Trevor, that, like, for example, in Yours Is No Disgrace, that that little line that they do at the beginning, that Steve insisted that Trevor not play that just let him do that, and that they would find something else for him to do to showcase him. But Trevor always refused, and he always played it with them, but he, of course, never played it exactly the same as Steve did. So he had this kind of, you know, cacophony of notes going on in there. So sometimes it was together, sometimes it was not together. Yeah. And I know Steve used to always get so annoyed with that, right? So I think that's one of the things that caused tension amongst them.
Yes, I'm sure it did. But, from what I could see, that there certainly was interaction, musical interaction, between those two guitarists and everybody else as well, which is wonderful for the crowd to see. And I did think that it didn't get crowded. There are lots of occasions on which it could have got musically crowded with two drummers, two guitarists, two keyboardists. But really, I think they do exceptionally well with the arrangements, even if Howe did get rather upset with Trevor not doing what he said. Now, you mentioned Bill Bruford there, and I was very impressed watching this back again that the electronic kit, I mean, he has got electronic kits, but he's also got acoustic instruments there as well, the cymbals, and I think he's using an acoustic snare. So not completely electronic like it was for ABWH, which was only a couple of years previous to this. But overall, I thought his electronic equipment fitted in a lot better here than perhaps on some of the live ABWH recordings that we have. And I wonder if that's the way he was combining with Alan, as you've already said. They played together, they complemented each other, and didn't seem to get in each other's way as perhaps Rabin and Howe might have done.
Yeah, exactly. I think that if Steve and Trevor were kind of like polar opposites, I think that Bill and Alan worked together perfectly. Like, they were in perfect, complementary to each other. I mean, because, even just take the beginning of Yours No Disgrace when they start with the first verse, yesterday, like Bill comes in with the little percussive parts on the Simmons drums. He does those little weird fills, but it sounds perfect with it. And then just leaves Alan to just do the hi-hat 16th notes there, just like he usually does. And that's one of the things I think that's so great about those two, is that they didn't step all over each other. When Bill wanted to play and do like the, keep the beat and be the main beat in a song, Alan was more than happy to let him do it, and it just showed that their work together was very complementary. Even in the duet, you could see how they would play together and it would be very complementary. And the one thing I always loved about their drum duet is when they zoomed on them, you could always see they had good facial connection while they were drumming, and they would smile and laugh if somebody did something funny or something that was a little off to each other. They had fun with it.
Yes.
That's the one thing I always loved about Bill, is that sure, he could be extremely serious about his music, but he knows how to have fun. That's the one thing I think Steve gets a little too, and don't take the offense to this, Kevin, when I say this, but sometimes he gets a little too British in his approach to stuff. He's a little too stiff-faced for me, like he should, lighten up a little,
Yeah, well, it's certainly true, isn't it, that Bill Bruford has a great sense of humor, as you say, which again, compliments. That's a word we're using a lot today, and I think it's there's a good reason for it. His intellect, yes, absolutely. His understanding of music is complemented by a really witty sense of humour and a British sense of humour. So, yes, I couldn't agree more. Now, thinking about the two keyboardists, and fascinating, I was reading, I think it was The Union, a Wikipedia entry, and Jonathan Elias, the villain of the piece, some would say, of the Union album, tried to persuade Rick Wakeman to use a Hammond organ. And allegedly and apparently, Rick would not do that in the studio with Jonathan Elias, because he said that it was too old-fashioned now in whatever it was, 1988, 89? No, 1990, 91, that kind of time, wasn't it, that they were recording Union, and he refused to do that. But here, although it's not an actual Hammond organ, it's an electronic version of it. Here we've got perhaps the ideal, haven't we, for a Yes sound. We've got the Rick Wakeman flashing all the way up and down the keyboard and roundabout, and lots of different instruments, and then Tony Kaye playing what he's best at, which is the Hammond sound, at least, and also other parts as well, of course. So once again, complementary playing on this Union live.
Yes, and I think that's another great example of a duet combination that worked extremely well, because I think that, even Rick would say that, Tony's organ playing is fantastic, very much his identity as a keyboard player. is the Hammond organ. And I think that, you know, he was more than happy to stay on that Hammond organ and do whatever he needed to do to complement the songs that way, and to let, you know, Rick jump all over the place between other keyboards and Moog and whatever he had with him to add in the other pieces. And and you know what? It worked really well. I mean, even Rick said it in the Union Live documentary that they did, the Yes Years documentary. There you go. Sorry. He talked about it there, how he said that, you know, he thought that it worked together very well because their sounds were different, but in comparison, like when they combine them, they sound so good. I mean, there are so many times in that show, like I have a really fantastic bootleg soundboard of a Union show from Pennsylvania, and it's amazing how the keyboards sound when they're playing stuff together. You know, it's just so full sounding. It's unbelievable. And I think that's a great example of, again, saying, you know, look, you do this, I'll do this. And they know what their strength is. Rick is very much strong on the lead playing end of things. He's very strong on piano, right? And so, you know, they do what they're strong at. I mean, and Rick even is no problem with, you know, stepping aside and letting, you know, Tony come out and do the introduction of, let's say, changes, which is obviously something that he did on albums. So, of course, he has to do it anyways. But, you know, if egos were overflowing, he could easily say, well, I can just do a harmony piece with you on top of that. You know, well, I'll harmonize the intro. You know, like it could have gotten really crazy.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why I think it is such a remarkable time of the band, because, you know, none of them perhaps were happy with Union the record, but the tour itself was really one of those moments in the history of the band, and there aren't very many, are there, where they did manage to get on well enough to go out on stage together many, many times. It wasn't a short tour at all. It was a long tour, even going to Japan and persuading Bill Bruford to go there in the end so that they had the whole lineup. So remarkable stuff. I just want to think about Union itself, the album, and which songs were played live. As I said in my piece a little earlier, there was only one, two, three, four, only five songs which were played from Union out of, what was it, 12 or 13, depending on which version you've got, 11, 12, anyway, however many it is. So when you look at the track list of Union, Mark, are there any other songs on there that you would have liked this lineup, or any other lineup for that matter, to play live?
Oh yeah, there's two songs that definitely stand out immediately that I would have loved to have heard done live. I Would Have Waited Forever, I think, would have been a great song to do live for sure. And of course, the one song that I was always so disappointed that it never did was The Miracle of Life. I thought that song would have been great to do. But the opener, I mean, I Would Have Waited Forever is fantastic. It definitely has elements of Steve Howe all over it. You know, and it's definitely, you can tell, one of the songs that section of Yes wrote. It wasn't the West Coast that wrote that. That was very much the Steve Howe faction.
Yes, absolutely. And there are bootleg copies, aren't there, of an ABWH2 album, which I was looking at again today when I was thinking about what we were going to say to each other. And yes, those songs would have taken perhaps a different turn. And, you know, the versions that we've got on Steve Howe's solo albums as well. But yes, I mean, I sought out and listened to and watched Take the Water to the Mountain the once that they actually played that. And it didn't go terribly well, I have to say. And some of the other ones obviously wouldn't work as well live.
Well, what I'm curious to ask you about is, you selected Shock to the System as the song that you talked about from that album. And you wrote something that I thought was very interesting in your piece, is that you said that you actually preferred the live version over the studio one.
Yeah. It just seemed to have a lot more life about it than the studio version. And certainly from my experience at the ARW concert, when Trevor really gets going, and with Chris there on the bass and Alan drums, etc., and the vocal harmonies all kick in, I think it's just an incredibly enjoyable live experience, whether you think it's the greatest music ever written. No, it's not the greatest music ever written, but those songs just seem to go down a storm. I mean, everybody loves it, and up and dancing and clapping and so on, and it's a real tonic to some of more serious ones. And I've got no problem at all with all the serious Yes songs. I would love to go and see all four sides of Tales from Topographic Oceans. Don't get me wrong. But on the other hand, it's great to have a straight ahead rock and roll number to enjoy, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then I guess the other one that you selected was Heart of the Sunrise, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. And that's there are so many different versions of that out there with different lineups of the band, and I love them all. And I think Heart of the Sunrise was the song I was most impressed by the first time I saw the band, which wasn't until 1998, was it? During the Open Your Eyes tour with Khrushchev playing the keyboards and Billy Sherwood there as well. And when that came on, I was just blown away. It was amazing to hear this thing live. And so it's always been one of my favorite live and recorded songs.
So curious, I got to ask you this. As we were talking about earlier about how, you know, some people were, you know, playing along well with their partner and others were not. And of course, you know, when we're talking about ones that don't play well with each other is Trevor and Steve. In this song, for example, that the keyboard line, that thing that Rick does on the Moog, Trevor a lot of times plays that with Rick on guitar.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that he should have stayed out, or do you mind that at all?
I did notice that specific thing that you mentioned there. I don't think it adds a great deal to have him playing that, particularly as it's incredibly difficult to coordinate that with. And so it goes slightly off time in the recording I watched of it. So it's a reasonable idea. You can certainly do that, and it gives a slightly different colouring to the sound. It makes it interesting, but no, I think he should have stayed away. Yeah, absolutely. Well, just going back to the songs that they didn't do, there are some obvious ones on here which wouldn't work as well live, I don't think, like Anchor Wat. I'm not sure that will go down particularly well.
Yeah.
And Evensong, those sorts of things. Of course, Evensong was the collaboration, wasn't that the one? The Levin and Bruford collaboration. I would love to hear Chris Squire and Bill Bruford doing that personally, but I don't think that's the sort of thing that they would necessarily have put in. But the nice thing about this, of course, is the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, Mark, which is the future. So here you had eight Yes musicians on the stage together, all, you know, and without exception, at some points, really enjoying being there and playing together and playing some music that really hasn't been returned to since then. So what about the future then? Because we've got lots of songs there you've just talked about. You've got Miracle of Life, Silent Talking, Would Have Waited Forever. So what I'm saying is this gives me hope for the future. So whoever's in the band, perhaps we can start looking more widely at some of this material and some of the material on, for example, Magnification or The Ladder or something else in the slightly more recent albums, rather than sticking entirely to older ones. Now, I know that the band has gone through the years, but things like Union should have a place in a future Yes concert lineup, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, there's this whole approach that bands have sometimes to their catalog is very interesting, I find, because there's always that one album. You know what I mean? Like when you talk to any band, you know, when you talk to Rush, for example, it's, you know, Caress of Steel. They kind of, that don't talk to me about that record. Or if you have Kiss and they're like, don't talk to me about The Elder, you know, or I'm sure Yes has that album too, where, you know, a lot of them kind of turned their nose up at Tornado because it wasn't a happy time for them then, you know. So don't talk about that record. Right? I mean, even we had Billy confirm that when we talked to him last time, but in Union is also that has that stigma as well, where they, you know, Rick Wakeman calls it onion, you know, because it makes him cry whenever he thinks about it. So I think that there's a lot of songs on here that can come across rather well in a live situation. And I think that time has passed enough. Enough water has gone under the bridge, so to speak. Mm. See how I did that there? Yeah. to kind of, you know, go ahead and bring back some of these songs. Like, for example, The More We Live, Let Go. I think that's one of the greatest songs that Billy wrote with Chris Squire. Mm. And they've even performed out of a Conspiracy, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Right? So, and we know that song can work well. You know, and like I said before, the reason why Miracle of Life hasn't been performed live to me is an absolute travesty. You know, that's such a great song. You know, that should be, you know, given an outing, I think. And, you know, a lot of these guys who are in the band now, like, you know, Jay Schellen, yeah. Billy Sherwood,
yeah.
You know, even Jeff Downes and that, a lot of these songs, you know, might have been songs that they liked as fans of the band before they even became members of the band. So to ask them to say, okay, hey, how about we pull out? I would have waited forever. Maybe they would be like, yeah, man, I'd love to play that. I would never have imagined us do that. You know what I mean? There would be some more enthusiasm. Of course, you might have to take out Steve Fredo a couple of pints of Guinness to convince him. But, you know, I think it could be possible, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's right. And certainly, every time we've spoken to Billy Sherwood, I'm sure he would love to play this kind of music, because in some ways it's influenced, I think, some of his own music. This union era of the band, and he talks about it very affectionately, because that's, you know, marks the first time that his name appears on a Yes album. So absolutely. Okay, right. Well, that's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you very much indeed, Mark. If you have comments, if you saw this tour, what did you think of it? Leave them on the show notes for this week. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half of the patrons. Yes Music podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Gervier and Wayne Hall. And in a new configuration, here are half of the Yes Music podcast patrons. Aaron Steelman, Mark James Lang, Martin Kelberg, Bob Martellotta, Michael O'Connor, Brian Sullivan, Miguel Falcao, Chris Bandini, Neil Caffrey, Craig Estenez, Paul Hales, Dave Owen, Paul Tomei, David Hayden, Paul Wilson, Lind, David Pannell, Lobate Scarp, Dave Watkinson, Rachel Hadaway, Dem, Mark Zarkle Bags, Doug Curran, Robert Naser, Fergus Cubbage, Scott Colombo, Fred Barringer, Scott Smith, and of course, continued thanks to Robert and David. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons and producers. If you'd like to join them and help keeping the lights on here at the new and improved YMP Towers, then please do head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.